This is Building Bridges, your community and labor report, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. We go south and north of the border with Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research and screenwriter of the new Oliver Stone documentary, South of the Border.
But first, we present some clips focusing on U.S. media treatment of Latin America from South of the Border.
All right. Something that I never knew was that I knew there were some dictators around the world.
Sure.
But did you know that some of the dictators now apparently, allegedly, are drug addicts as well? That might explain a few things. Hugo Chavez now admitting in a speech that went widely undocumented, by the way, that he chews cocoa every morning. And he also eats something called cocoa paste, which,
cocoa,
by the way, is addictive. And he gets it from the dictator in Bolivia.
What did you say?
Coca.
It is coca.
Oh, coca.
Coco.
Oh, coca would be fine.
Listen.
I don't know my narcotics as well.
See, it's a shame. For a moment, Gretchen, when you just said coco, I'd imagine people all across America just spit up cocoa butter.
Yeah. Wait. They thought they were going to get a high out of it today.
I'm an Ovaltine guy, but that's for another time. But what you're saying is, I read that too, and then they were people, I guess the reporters went on to define, what is he talking about? He gets his cocoa paste.
Coca.
Coca. I got you going down the cocoa paste.
You take a paste from?
Bolivia dictator. Is he a dictator too?
Millions of people watch these shows consistently, night and day, throughout North America. Do they believe what they see? I hope not. But even the more serious end of the networks and print media in North America and Europe divided the world into friends. That is, leaders who do what we want them to do, and enemies, leaders who tend to disagree with us. The electoral victory of Hugo Chavez, despite his many critics, was a triumph for Venezuelan democracy. But there is a problem with democracy. As practiced in the South, it can throw up politicians who refuse to accept the
dictates. Well, that was a segment from South of the Border. It's unbelievable, and yet it's the reality of our mass media in the way they look at and understand contemptuously, even stupidly, some of the great intellectual minds that are now ruling a number of the countries in Latin America. And with that, we're going to take a look at South and North of the Border. Filmmaker Oliver Stone, with his screenwriters Mark Weisbrot and Tariq Ali, celebrate the new reality of the independence won by most of the countries of Latin America from U.S. hegemony. They shed new light upon the existing transformations in the region.
Mark Weisbrot joins us to speak about the developments south and north of the border and how the U.S. is imposing at home the kind of austerity bloodletting that it once reserved for poor, indebted countries, including the looming attack on the Social Security Trust Fund.
Now, south and north of the border with Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, president of Just Foreign Policy, and screenwriter of the new Oliver Stone documentary, South of the Border. Mark, did you write in that compilation, that montage of from Fox News? Did they give it to you for free, that stupid, barbaric... humorous.
I gotta admit, it's really funny.
It really is. I mean, some of the comedians, the Colbert and other folks, they couldn't have even made this up.
Yeah, I put that in there. And I had another one, actually, that I wanted to roll the screen credits at the end with, which is the Fox and Friends, the same show, where they got confused between Hugo Chavez and Cesar Chavez.
Oh, God, please.
And that was pretty funny, too.
I'm surprised they knew either one.
But, you know, one thing that bothered me about all the reviews is they all pretend that we're just making fun of Fox News or the others say television media. But, in fact, the New York Times gets hit pretty hard in this movie. We show how they supported, actually wrote an editorial board editorial. The editorial board of the New York Times wrote an editorial on April 12, 2002, endorsing the coup that overthrew the democratically elected government. And then we also show that a couple of days later, they had to write another one that kind of grudgingly retracted it. It's very clear that the print media is you know, their reporting is a little bit better than the TV media, but their editorials is what most people read. You know, most people, the ones that do read newspapers in the United States, they get their, they hear anything about Latin America, it's usually from the editorials, and those are quite atrocious. I mean, the Washington Post editorials on Latin America are, you know, they're sometimes to the right of Fox. And then, of course, you know, most of the clips in the movie are not Fox, the TV clips. They're CNN, they're broadcast news. So we made clear that it was the whole media. It was very clear in that movie. And the reviews in the print media all kind of tried to pretend that it was just Fox or TV.
Mark, I just want to say that for me, the most critical part of the film and that which gave real dignity and voice to self-determination were the voices of Evo Morales, the voices that came together of Rafael Correa, and some of the new leadership that has emerged in Latin America. And that was invaluable and generally unavailable to us.
Thanks. Yeah, I was glad to be able to put that in there. Also, you know, it's interesting to see the reviews because, you know, obviously most of them trash the movie. And, they, you know, a lot of them trash it for, well, you know, not having enough substance. And then most of these reviews couldn't even get the presidents right. So maybe it was too complex for the reviewers. You know, we're going to have a contest on the web this week where you get to pick the stupidest mistake made in reviews of South of the Border. And my only worry is that people aren't going to have time to read through all the mistakes that were made because it's such a long, long list. The worst, the most was probably Larry Roeder's 1,600-word piece in the New York Times art section. They had another review in the New York Times, which was actually not bad, but he did this long thing where he tried to challenge the factual accuracy of the film, and of course he failed miserably because there weren't any factual mistakes in it. And he tried to make some up.
Mark, what really impressed me about the film was that all of these Latin American leaders from a number of different countries are all asserting their independence from the United States. What policies of the United States are they asserting their independence from?
Well, that's a good question. But all of these presidents had to challenge the United States in one way or another in order to deliver on their electoral promises. So obviously Venezuela is the extreme case. I mean, the United States supported not just supported, really was involved in a military coup against Venezuela in April of 2002. And so Chavez had to fight he had to fight the United States just to stay in power. The Kirchners had to battle in Argentina, had to battle with the IMF. Took over an economy that was just recovering, starting in 2003. And the IMF, which was, for Latin America at the least, and in developing countries in general, is controlled by the U.S. Treasury Department with very little input from Europe or anyone else. They had to fight against the U.S. Treasury and the IMF just to implement the basic macroeconomic policies that led to their recovery, which was, taking a hard line against the foreign creditors. They defaulted on about two-thirds of the debt because if they would have tried to pay more, they never would have recovered. They had a macroeconomic policy that the IMF didn't like, which is basically having the central bank target a stable and competitive real exchange rate, which is very important to the recovery. And they had a whole number of policies that they really had to face off. In fact, in September of 2003, they temporarily defaulted to the IMF just for a little bit, until less than a week, until the IMF backed down. And they had a rough, very rough time, but they won. They had 6 years of 63% economic growth, pulled 11 million people out of poverty, and they never could have done it without fighting the United States. Evo Morales had to say no to the IMF, offered him an agreement when he took office in 2006. They had been under IMF agreements for 20 years straight and had an income per person that was less than it was 27 years earlier. And Evo wanted to renationalize the natural gas. Well, of course, once he got rid of the IMF, he was able to do that. But prior governments would have had a much harder time getting just control over their own resources. And then Abel's had a big fight with the U.S. even now. You know, they don't have diplomatic, they don't have ambassadorial relations with the United States. Abel kicked out the U.S. ambassador in 2008, and they still haven't settled their differences. The United States has trade sanctions against Bolivia right now. And this is really incredible when you think about it. I mean, this is a country where it's an indigenous majority. They were unrepresented in the political system until Abel took office in 2006. And so this is like the end of apartheid in South Africa. You would think that this government would have enough sense for the United States to be on the right side of a struggle like
that.
Well,
Mark,
they can't do it.
You know, one of the things that, of course, that is interesting, the film was completed before talking about the right side of history, the coup in Honduras, and of course the Obama administration eventually really capitulated to the coup leaders in this terrible coup, which has now led to gross repression throughout the country in what was a burgeoning democracy, and a democracy that represented wresting back the country from the economic hegemony of the U.S. So it's kind of painful as one gets to that film. But there's another interesting piece, and you see that with Hugo Chavez looking over the shoulder of Lula da Silva from Brazil. And they say, well, what are some of the things you want? And he mentions a couple of things, I think four of them. And one of the things that he talks about would be a kind of just Middle East policy, a real. So you again see the growing integrity and representation and self-determination politically of many of the Latin American countries when faced with the still continuing, albeit perhaps more covert, U.S. interventions.
Yeah, I think you can see, and that's part of the movie where they ask Lula, you know, we asked Lula, what do you expect? What would you expect from the Obama administration? He says, first, lift the embargo on Cuba. Second, you know, a more just policy, as you mentioned, in the Middle East. And third, he said, you know, invite President Chavez to come to the United States and sit down and talk with him. And to him, these were just reasonable things, right? And they all these leaders had really high expectations of Obama, or at least high hopes, you know. Lula, I remember, you know, before Obama was even elected, he said, you know, just as we elected a metal worker here in Brazil and the Bolivians, you know, elected an indigenous leader, and Venezuela elected Chavez, and Paraguay elected a progressive bishop, it would be great to see a black man elected in the United States, you know. And they really saw Obama's election as kind of a continuation of all these progressive elections in South America. And they did expect some change. And they are now extremely disappointed, I can tell you that. And Honduras was one, was a real eye-opener, I think, and a real disappointment. And I would go just a little bit further than you in terms of capitulation. I think they did more than that. I think the Obama administration, and I wrote like 7 or 8 articles that you can find on our website about this, it's cepr.net, they really did everything they could to help that coup government succeed, and including actively blocking the Organization of American States from taking stronger measures against the coup regime. And so it really has been, you know, this administration has, I would say, done a little bit worse than Bush with respect to Latin America.
Mark, I wanted to break in for just a second because we've only got about 3 minutes left, and I did want to talk a little bit about north of the border, because we're having the debt problems here right now, and some of those IMF policies seems like they're being imposed on us right now.
Well, we haven't quite gotten there yet. I mean, we've had a stimulus. It was 2 weeks. It was, you know, maybe enough to make up for about a tenth of the lost demand that we lost from the collapse of the housing and commercial real estate bubbles. So we haven't gotten to the point where we're really pursuing a pro-cyclical policy like they're trying to push in Spain and Portugal and Ireland and Greece and actually have done. But they're definitely talking about it, and there is a fight going on right now. And, of course, I'm sure you saw Congressman Boehner's infamous statement about how we have to cut Social Security to pay for the war in Afghanistan. It's unfortunate that the Democrats are not fighting this, and they are. You know, there's too many of them talking about cutting the deficit, and, of course, this is really the wrong time to do this one. You have unemployment still near 10%, and a lot worse than that, as you all know, when you count all the people who are working part-time or otherwise not working. They're not part of the official rate. So, yeah, we're going to have quite a struggle over the next couple of years against the deficit hawks and the people who really do want to take, you know, measures that would make the economy worse when unemployment's already going to be intolerably high for years to come.
You know, one of the ways I was thinking of ending and bringing it together, North and South, is when Tariq Ali in the film South of the Border says, yeah, maybe what we can do when we look at immigration is a kind of reverse trend. That was his quote-unquote utopian hope, that some of the progressive ideas of the working class, the peasants moving from Latin America through to this country, that they would bring some of those groundswell of ideas against privatization and against the policies of the IMF and take hold and take sway here. And maybe we have an awful lot to learn from South of the Border.
I guess I would see it more, first of all, yeah, the demographic change is going to change the politics of the United States. So in that sense, I think that's true. But also even at the higher levels, I mean, look what Lula did recently. You know, he brokered with Turkey. They did something that middle-income countries really haven't done before. They challenged the rich powers, and they did what Obama said that he wanted. They went to Iran, and they negotiated an agreement for a nuclear fuel swap. And that really changed the dynamic, not only within the United Nations, but in the world, in terms of slowing down the momentum towards more sanctions and an eventual military conflict. So this is one of the reasons why the United States, Washington, hates so much to lose power in Latin America, because it changes the geopolitics of the entire world.
Well, we're going to have you back to also look at one of the many things, but particularly one of the issues that you've done a good deal of work around, and that is the looming attack on the Social Security Trust Fund. And Mark Weisbrot, thank you for involving yourself with Oliver Stone and Tariq Ali doing the screenwriting on this very important new film, South of the Border. Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, president of Just Foreign Policy, and screenwriter of the new Oliver Stone documentary, South of the Border.
Continuing on our theme of exploring the growing independence of Latin America from U.S. dominance, Building Bridges brings you highlights of Ecuadorian President Correa's presentation on the crisis of global capital to a packed chamber at the UN Conference on Economic Development. Correa sharply criticized the policies of the International Monetary Fund and went so far as to advocate its abolition. He then proceeded with a sharp critique of capitalism's relentless drive for profits.
One of the biggest crises of the developing world, and Latin America in particular, we were colonized even to the point of our thought. Economic and social policies that we followed have been dictated by the Washington Consensus. What a pompous name, the Consensus. It turns out the Consensus was institutions that represent world power, the international bureaucracy based in Washington, the financial bureaucracy, IMF, World Bank, and the U.S. State Department. And that was called Consensus, a consensus in which Latin America never participated. The region basically took on those recipes without even daring to challenge the thinking behind them. All of that is changing. And in Latin America, there are signs of hope. Neoliberal policies and the governments that embrace these policies for into the region have fallen like a house of cards. Progressive governments are coming into power that really answer to their people. We have a great deal to say. It is time to come together and create something better and something our own. This session has been called People's Rights, Not Corporate Profits. We fully agree with this outlook. People first. These policies that have been implemented in Latin America were designed solely in light of the interests of capital. With all public policies being geared to capital, however clumsy the policies might be. I'll give you examples of intolerable situations. It's incredible to see how capital has more rights than human beings. The working class have been one of the big victims of the long and sad night of neoliberalism, since everything has been geared to capital, all public policy, economic and social policy. Human beings, the labor force, the beginning and end of production and of the economy, were converted into just one more instrument for capital accumulation. Forms of labor exploitation, euphemistically called labor flexibilization, became widespread. For example, outsourcing. This was used as a mechanism to deny labor rights. Ecuador established a contract by hours law. Those workers received below the minimum wage. So all you had there was labor exploitation. One of the great victims of the long and sad night of neoliberalism has been the workforce, and human work was reduced to just one more tool for accumulation of capital. The World Bank and the IMF are going to carry out their studies, which are really just multi-million dollar marketing campaigns in order to get that measure to be adopted. Capital mobility is one of the main factors of instability in poor countries. But you could say anything silly in support of capital. For example, the need for autonomous central banks. Autonomous from their people, but totally dependent on large capital and the international bureaucracies. If fiscal policy is under the executive, why not monetary policy? What democratic legitimacy do the central bank bureaucrats have to adopt decisions that affect the entire society? But as it was in the interest of capital, the World Bank immediately held seminars throughout Latin America, and in the 1990s, almost all the central banks of Latin America became autonomous central banks with no control by the executive, but quite a bit of control by the international bureaucracy. That was the trick. The spearhead of big capital, Wall Street, and the IMF, so that independent of the government in power, the same economic policy geared to capital would continue. That's why the title of this gathering, People's Rights, Not Corporate Profits, is right on target. People first. Behind all of this is the collapse of the neoliberal paradigm, the one that tried to convince us that the driving force of society is individualism, that the proper way to go about things is competition as among persons and as among countries, and that one had to subject lives, societies, and persons to this entity called the marketplace. Nothing is farther from the truth. The World Trade Organization is part of this fundamentalism. That free trade always benefits everyone? That's false. And look at history. Practically none of the so-called developed countries developed based on free trade, but rather based on planning, protecting nascent industries with collective action to generate production, employment, and so on. And today, they are preaching what they never practiced. And this is a good lesson for the developing countries. What we're doing is looking more and more like that savage capitalism of the 19th century, where there were no labor regulations, no control for big capital. It was the Industrial Revolution. Workers were perishing in front of their machines, working 16 hours a day, Saturdays, Sundays, children, and so forth. How were those abuses brought to a halt? Through collective action to control those excesses. That institutional framework doesn't exist internationally. So all the excesses we've seen, and we see the trap that the developing countries have fallen into, wanting to enter into competition among one another, which is another barbarity. in many cases, cooperation yields better output and results than competition. What do we do when we compete with one another? We benefit the first world. How have we competed with one another to put our products in the first world? Worsening labor conditions. We've impoverished our labor force. We have transferred wealth to the first world. The human being has been subsidiary to the capital, when the center of the economy and development should be the human being. This needs to change. Capital has more rights than human beings. Well, this is an absurdity that we need to get past. But what is collapsing is this dominant view. It's not a crisis that's outside the capitalist system. It's a crisis that is inherent to the capitalist system. Consequently, something new and different is needed. Responsible for this collapse, prejudicing especially the developing countries, we are not the ones who are the authors of this crisis, but we are the ones who suffer the brunt of it. I refer, for example, the IMF. Yesterday I was talking with Daniel Ortega, and I think the indecency of the IMF is incredible. Instead of apologizing or saying a mea culpa, analyzing what it's done, to lend Nicaragua $90 million, Daniel Ortega was telling me, they want to freeze wages, pensions, get rid of all subsidies. These are the conditions they want to impose on Nicaragua. So it continues to be an instrument of the foreign policy of certain countries, which history has shown don't work. It continues to be an instrument for subjugating. So we're not going to find a solution in the system itself. We're not going to find a solution with those players whose group contributed to, whose caused this crisis. Well, if you ask me, the IMF should simply disappear. The Bretton Woods institutions, IMF. They've been one of the main factors in destabilizing world demand. They've failed in their mission, and the IMF, especially with all the blame it bears for exploitation, our country should simply disappear.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our new website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.